The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, the Loch Ree Monster.
Some people say that there's a potential for commercial activities, that Loch Ree can become a rival to Loch Ness in the monster tourism stakes.
Ian Kennelly on the strange creature spotted in the Midlands in 1960 and how it became a media sensation. Also, the legacy of T.K. Whittaker.
Ken Whittaker's political masters, had fought for Irish freedom. And not just Whittaker, but his generation, they felt equally obliged to work for Ireland.
Anne Chambers joins me to discuss the many aspects of Whittaker's work that have particular resonance for Ireland and the world today. And to begin this evening, the life of Donegal storyteller Seamus McManus, who was described as the last Shanachie. Born in 1868, Seamus McManus immersed himself in the folklore of his home county of Donegal before bringing those tales to a wider audience, particularly among the Irish diaspora in North America. His books, like The Story of the Irish Race, magazine articles and lecture tours, found a devoted audience far beyond Irish shores, helping to shape how generations of Irish Americans understood their heritage. But while he was a key figure in the cultural revival of the early 20th century, his legacy has been somewhat overlooked in recent years. Our reporter, Mark McMenamin, has been finding out more.
He's an unusual figure in that he has a foot in both camps. He has a foot in the Anglo-Irish revival, the cultural revival of the late 19th and early 20th century. He also has a very solid footing in the Irish language revival.
He starts sort of instrumentalizing the Irishness that he derived from his Donegal background.
Seamus McManus, writer and self-styled Shanachie, was born in Mount Charles, County Donegal, in 1868. Educated in Enniskillen in nearby Fermanagh, McManus soon began to collect Donegal folklore from local rambling houses, which he eventually popularised to a huge extent through his published work in North America. This is Brian O'Connor, Professor of Irish Language and Literature at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana.
His first book appeared in 1893, and that was just when the Gaelic League was founded. So he was part of that wave. He moved in the same circles as Lady Gregory, as Yeats, as Douglas Hyde, as Owen McNeill. What distinguishes him is his presence in America, in American universities, and his great book, The Story of the Irish Race.
According to Breen, McManus's work, The Story of the Irish Race, gave meaning and a sense of history to the first generation of Irish Americans post the famine.
It's at a time where Irish America, Catholic Irish America, is beginning to find its voice. McManus is the voice of rural Ireland, the voice of the Irish revival in American universities, in American colleges. He's the one that speaks and represents Irish culture, Irish literature to the emerging, rising Irish Catholic middle class.
McManus's writing was hugely popular with the diaspora in North America. This is Chris Cusack, Professor of English Literature at Radboud University in the Netherlands.
In America, of course, people were very interested in Irish culture and also in the Irish revival as a sort of way that they couldn't link back to their own heritage. And we're really talking particularly about, second, third generation migrants here. So not necessarily the people who themselves had come over from Ireland, but the people who were descended from, people who came over from Ireland during the famine or afterwards. The Gaelic revival, the Celtic revival, really becomes a way for these people in North America to identify as Irish. And that is, I think, one of the reasons why his work was so popular, because at the time in America, there was a huge vogue for this kind of Irishness.
Great, noble, and beautiful truly was our Tara of the Kings. From the great heart and centre of the Irish kingdom, five great arteries or roads radiated from Tara to the various parts of the country. The Sliagh Cuilan, which ran toward the present County Wicklow, the Sliagh Mór, the Great Western Road, which ran via Dublin to Galway, the Sliagh Aisle, which ran near the present Mullingar, the Sliagh Dala.
McManus lectured widely in the United States, beginning in Notre Dame in 1903. Breen O'Connivar.
He appears to have come to Notre Dame for the first time in 1903, and his connection was with Father Kavanagh, who was Irish-American, and Kavanagh took it upon himself to improve the academic standard of Notre Dame, to make it from a small college in northwest Indiana, dealing with first-generation Irish-Americans, the children of those who came over during the famine, and he wanted to up the standard, and he was concerned that Notre Dame was going to become only known as a football college.
McManus was particularly popular with university students, according to Breen.
The students at Notre Dame and other universities were very impressed and enamoured with McManus as a storyteller, as a raconteur. He may not have been a world-class critic or academic, but he was the voice of the tradition. He was the voice of the folk culture in the west of Ireland, Donegal in particular. But he could marry that to a sense of cultural pride and cultural history.
Professor Chris Cusack.
He was very popular because of the Irish dimension, so because of that revivalist dimension, but also because he wrote local colour stories. And this is when the genre of local colour was really, really popular around Europe, the United States, Canada, etc. So in that sense, it wasn't necessarily the fact that he was Irish that was so interesting, but the fact that people were very interested in the way that he generated a sense of the region, a sense of the local.
These tales were made not for reading, but for telling. They were made and told for the passing of long nights, for the shortening of weary journeys, for entertaining of traveller guests, for brightening of cabin hearths. Be not content with reading them, and grateful be to the Shanachies who passed these tales to me, for you.
Seamus McManus's writing was very well received in the United States. However, he also maintained close links with Mount Charles, where he returned every summer and would tell his stories in the evenings at the local water pump, which today bears an inscription with his name.
I think that in terms of also the influence he's had in partly popularising this kind of Irishness in America, in the UK, more attention should be paid to him. And I think also, particularly the early kind of stories that he published, you know, there are quite a lot of stories though there that are very interesting. He also published a number of stories, for instance, that do represent a very Ulster kind of perspective, where he, you know, semi-satirically writes about mixed marriages in Donegal in the late 19th century, you know, a Catholic woman, a Protestant man, or vice versa, right? And he writes about this, you know, with a great sense of humour.
Seamus McManus passed away in New York at the age of 92 in 1960. He is buried alongside his first wife, the author Ethna Carberry, in Frosses, County Donegal.
From all accounts, he seems to have been a natural storyteller. He seems to have been able to convey to students the colour, the atmosphere, the feeling of Donegal. And remember, this is the first generation. So he is relaying and describing to people what their parents, grandparents had grown up with. He gave a narrative form to the history, to the origins of the Irish race. And it gave the Irish a story, an origin story, at a time when they badly needed it.
And that was Breen O'Connachar, ending that report on the life and work of Seamus McManus. And our reporter, historian and author Mark McMenamin joins me now in studio to talk more about this Donegal storyteller. Tell us a bit, first of all, Mark, about his early life in Donegal and the collection of folklore in, I think, what was referred to in the package as the Rambling Houses. What's a rambling house?
Well, thanks very much for having me, Miles. Yeah, McManus is a very interesting person. He was born in 1868 in Mount Charles, and it's important to make that distinction. In Donegal, we pronounce it Mount Charles, you know, as opposed to Mount Charles, which is an unusual Donegalism, but that's what it is. McManus was born in the area, the son of a local farmer, Patrick McManus, and his mother was from nearby Drumholm, which is a little bit closer to Donegal town. So that's the general lay of the land. And he was educated, actually, in Enniskillen. Outside Enniskillen, first in Canalia and then in Enniskillen town. He was acutely aware of the kind of the folklore of Donegal because he grew up in it, and he went to these rambling houses. So rambling, well, I suppose it was very well known in Donegal. I'm sure it took place in other parts of the country as well. Rambling was where you went to other people's houses for a ramble and you told stories by the fireside. But the unique thing about McManus was that he decided he was going to write these down. So after his education in Enniskillen, he started writing his stories down, initially first for the Donegal Vindicator, or the Tyrconnell Vindicator, which was a very well-known weekly publication published in Donegal. It was actually published in my hometown of Ballyshannon, which was also where the Donegal Democrat was originally published as well. So he put in short stories, poems, cures, and kind of local stories of fairies and folklore that he'd picked up from local people along the way, initially in the Vindicator, and then he transitions on then to publishing kind of nationally for a publication in Dublin called The Shamrock. And eventually then he starts writing for international publications. I suppose the biggest one and the first one that kind of brought him to a wider audience was Le Petit Journal. Through that, he was sent over on, I suppose, kind of an assignment to the United States, where he was to interview kind of prominent Irish business people and people that were involved in the burgeoning kind of nationalist movement there at the time. It's there that he has his great opportunity then to bring his stories to a wider audience.
Before he goes to the States, though, he struck up a friendship with one Pádraig Pearse, who I think stayed with him whenever Pearse visited Donegal.
Yeah, Pearse stayed with him in Mount Charles when he actually visited Donegal, and the two of them struck up a kind of a great rapport. Actually, McManus was on the board of Scolenda. He was also involved in various other kind of, you know, nationalist movements. He was a founding member of the Gaelic League of the branch in Donegal. He actually organised the very first meeting, county board meeting of Donegal GAA in Mount Charles. He was involved in setting up local 1798 commemoration committee, and he was determined to kind of involve himself in as many ways as possible in all these sort of soft nationalist movements. It's interesting, in his later life, he kind of, you know, his relationship, I suppose, was a little bit strained then with Pearse as time went on. Pearse felt that, I suppose, when McManus was writing his stories in America, that they had wandered into the area of kind of paddywhackery, you know, as opposed to kind of articulating the cause, as it were, in Ireland. And he felt that kind of, in a way, demeaned the nationalist cause. So there was a kind of a falling out between them.
Tell us then about his publishing career in the US. He became hugely successful. And I mean, some of the magazines that he was writing for are extraordinary. Harper's Monthly, Cosmopolitan, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, well, he initially arrives in the United States to begin kind of lecturing in some of the universities. And he starts publishing his stories alongside that. He publishes kind of, I suppose, little extracts and pieces from these stories that he picked up in the rambling houses. And they're met with huge interest by the local people. And he realised as well himself that this is a fairly lucrative market. So he, you know, his output increased dramatically. I mean, it's been said that at one stage he was selling stories to some of these magazines for the modern day equivalent of about 10,000 euros a story. So he became quite wealthy through his work. That led him on then into the university scene, and I suppose the most famous university that he was lecturing in was the University of Notre Dame in South Bend in Indiana. And there's some very interesting kind of correspondence between himself and the students. And if you look back at the archives and you look at some of the student publications, they speak so fondly of McManus. The students were actually mad about him. A little quotation here from one of them in the Notre Dame Scholastic of the 6th of February, 1904. They talk about a pleasant hour with a noted Irish storyteller. And Seamus McManus from Donegal, the author of several volumes on stories and a frequent contributor to many leading American magazines, has addressed the students in Washington Hall on the subject of Irish wit and humour. And seldom has there been seen a happier treatment of a person attending. You know, so he was held in very high regard by the students and the faculty there.
Not held in such high regard by the likes of Owen McNeill and W.B. Yeats. Yeats was pretty much doing the same kind of thing, but presumably wasn't making quite as much money out of it as McManus was. Was there a certain amount of economic or financial jealousy there, do you think?
There may well have been. I mean, Yeats was, you know, visiting the universities as well, but not with the same frequency with McManus. And he didn't stay for the same duration of time. You know, it might be a one-off lecture, whereas McManus would stay there for extended periods of time. And he would give series and series of lecture. He might give 10, 12 different lectures in a rotating process. And what happened was, through the publication of his books, and the attention that he was attracting, and he was becoming quite wealthy, he kind of drew the ire then of some of his contemporaries. And, you know, perhaps it's a reason why he's not maybe as well known. His output certainly wasn't in the same academic vein or the same quality of literature as Yeats, but he was selling a lot more at that particular time, and that might have drawn the ire of them.
And, I mean, his books are still in print in the USA.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. It's quite difficult to get your hands on some of the books in Ireland, but you can get them in almost any shop in America, you know, in any popular Irish history section, in any kind of Irish literature section. They actually turn up quite a bit as well in kind of bargain bins, you know. You can get first edition books of Seamus McManus, of his many works, particularly the story of the Irish race, because it was a very important text in terms of giving the generation that came after the first wave of family immigrants, it gave them a sense of identity and a sense of belonging and a sense of who they were at a time when they were trying to find themselves in North America. And that has been his legacy.
He was married twice. Tell me about his first and second wives, both very, very interesting women.
Well, his first wife, whom he married in 1901, was the famous author Ethna Carberry, and he was very devoted to her. Unfortunately, she died of gastritis. The two of them lived for a while, actually, in Revlin House in Donegal Town. And anyone that's been to Donegal Town will know where that is. It's a beautiful house that's on the Bank Walk that's looking out over Donegal Bay. And they lived there for a while together. When she died, she was buried in Frosses, which is just up the road from Donegal Town. Then, later on in life, he marries the granddaughter of the first president of Venezuela, a lady by the name of Catalina Violante Paez. They married in New York in 1911. Her grandfather was General José Antonio Paez, who was first president of Venezuela. And they had two daughters together, Mariquita and Patricia. And the family is still, you know, living and working in the United States today.
And he did come over and back. He came, visited Donegal regularly. He doesn't die until 1960. So there were probably people around in Donegal who actually remember it. But he died at the age of 92, but not of old age.
No, he has quite a tragic ending. He dies at the age of 92. He fell out of the window of the nursing home in which he was staying in Midtown Manhattan. And it's quite a tragic end. There's very little kind of sources on, I suppose, on the actual exact nature of the death. There are some references to it in some of the New York newspapers, none that I have seen in some of the Irish newspapers. When he died, his body was repatriated then. He was brought back to Donegal, and he was actually buried in Frosses alongside the body of his first wife, Ethna Carberry. Frosses is a little town where there's not a lot in it now. So you have the graveyard and the church in which he is buried on one side of it. Other side, you have a shop and a couple of houses, you know. Now, when I was growing up locally in Donegal, one of the local witticisms was that, you know, up in Frosses, one side of the town doesn't talk to the other. But I think that's very fitting for Seamus McManus, because his books are full of wit. You know, he had some very witty sayings. You know, one in particular, it was that many's a man's tongue broke his nose. And another one that I thought was particularly humorous was, you know, that fella is as good as his word, but his word is no good. You know? So I think, you know, it's interesting that that's where he was buried.
Well, thanks very much indeed, Mark, for talking to us and for reminding us about Seamus McManus, the last Shanachie. And thank you very much for joining us on The History Show.
Thanks, Miles.
After the break, the Loch Ree Monster, the strange creature spotted in the Midlands in 1960 and how it became a media sensation. Welcome back. On a calm evening in May 1960, three Catholic priests took a rowing boat across Loch Ree on the River Shannon. They were in the midst of what had been a quiet fishing holiday, but as the sun dipped towards the horizon, they saw something unexpected. A dark shape gliding through the water, large, silent, and, they thought, alive. Within hours, the media had latched onto their story, and the Loch Ree Monster was born. Newspapers splashed it across their front pages, reporters flocked to Athlone, and a businessman put up a reward for the creature's capture, dead or alive. Wild theories took hold. Some swore it was a prehistoric animal. Others suggested it was, wait for it, a Soviet submarine. The story would eventually draw in old IRA men, amateur hunters, and a high-powered British investigative team, among many others. To learn more about that story and its eclectic cast of characters, I'm joined by Ian Kennelly, historian and our History Show researcher. Let's begin with the discovery with the three priests. Who were they? What did they see?
Okay, so it's the 18th of May 1960, and these three priests are on their fishing holiday. They are Richard Quigley, Matthew Burke, and Daniel Murray. It's about 9 or 9.30 in the evening, and they see this shape, a dark shape, moving silently through the water. They don't know what it is, but they observe it for quite a while. When they come back to shore, they start telling locals about what they'd seen or what they'd encountered, to put it that way. The word reaches a guy called Colonel Harry Rice, who'd been formerly in the British Army, stationed in India, but now living in Athlone. Very well-liked character, still remembered in the locality to this day, but he's also very well-connected. And he immediately rings press offices in Dublin, Independent, the Press and so on. And the story, you know, gathers legs or gathers fins immediately. And the press starts putting it on their front pages, because that's initially how I discovered the story. I was researching a package last year on the state's response to nuclear war, and I was looking at the front page of the Irish Press one day, and I saw, you know, three priests on a boat see a big monster, and it immediately grabbed my attention. So you can see that immediately there's this furore, and the priests, you know, effectively become side characters as the press latches onto the story, and it becomes more outlandish over the following days.
And one of the priests involved spoke to RTE for a radio documentary in 1979.
It was moving on a straight line, and we all three of us watched it, and its movement was very smooth. It almost glided at a very slow pace across the water, causing little or no disturbance. It gave the impression of swimming with some flippers or that would be much deeper down in the water. And we watched it, and a minute or so, I don't know how long it was, because we were kind of fascinated by the appearance of the thing. And then, almost as a submarine submerging, it submerged. And it just gradually sank, the head and the leading section and the hump submerged under the water.
And that was one of the three priests who made the sighting, speaking to RTE in 1979. So that's where the story begins, but what was the local reaction then?
Well, immediately there's public meetings and so on, and there's a lot of speculation in the locality as to what it is, and there's kind of two strands of thought. There's people who, like Harry Rice and others, who tried to discern what it actually was, that it was a trick of the light or that it was a mundane everyday occurrence that was just misidentified. And then there is speculation among some that it is some kind of creature. And Rice himself comes to the conclusion that it's a coelacanth, which was famous at the time because that was a fish that was long believed to be extinct, known only through the fossil record. But in 1930s, it was Marjorie Courtney Latimer, a South African naturalist. She discovered living examples of the fish, and that became a sensation at the time. So that was in the public consciousness, but, you know, that's a fish that is a deep sea fish. It lives at 700 metres or up to 700 metres depth. You know, Loch Ree is at its most 36 metres deep. It didn't fit. So that solution was put aside. And as some people tried to put a scientific spin in it, others were looking at more macabre or fearsome aspects of the story, and fishermen came forward to say that their boats had been attacked, or they had nearly been dragged under the surface of the lake by something pulling on their nets. And there was even this story that the creature's body had been found on the banks of the Shannon, and that just turned out to be a dead cow. But then that story morphed into a different tale, that the cow had actually been killed by the creature that had pulled it into the water to feed. And so you can see that there's these different stories. But then as it develops, people can see that they quite enjoy the press coverage and the media coverage that's in the locality. And there's some people say that there's a potential for commercial activities, you know, that Loch Ree can become a rival to Loch Ness in the monster tourism stakes. And people push that aspect, but then others, you know, it is at the height of the Cold War or during the Cold War, and as those Cold War tensions are running through, and a local councillor called Frank Waters suggests that apparently military aircraft had been spotted over the lake in the weeks leading up to this sighting or encounter, and he put forward the idea that these military aircraft may have been Soviet, and that they may have dropped a miniature submarine into the lake for whatever reason, who knows. But that obviously the press picked up on that, and it helped the story grow.
Now, some locals, obviously, they had a scientific or more likely a commercial interest in the story. Others had a rather more bloodthirsty attitude.
Yeah, yeah. As the story developed and people came forward with this, you know, tales of being harassed by the creature, you see letters in local newspapers such as the Westmeath Independent and so on, suggestions that, you know, we should bomb the lake. And one fisherman, and that actually becomes a reality, as we'll see in a few years later, but one guy writes to the paper saying he's a fisherman in the lake and this creature, whatever it is competition. So the best way to do it is to destroy it. And another guy suggests that, another letter writer, that the lake should be electrified somehow and that'll kill the creature. But then Harry Royce intervenes, a kind of a save the creature movement opens up temporarily in Athlone. And he says, look, no, this is a, you know, there's two reasons. It's a living creature. Apparently, we shouldn't kill it. But also, if it does get killed or captured, it'll end up in the Natural History Museum or Dublin Zoo, and Athlone will have no benefit from this wonderful discovery. But the most concrete example is an old IRA guy, well known in the town, from a family called the McCanns, Tom McCann. And he's a business owner, spent a lot of time in New York, and he puts forward a reward for the capture of the creature, £100, dead or alive. And now that doesn't bring any big game hunters to Westmead, but it does bring attention in the form of what's called a frogman, a guy called Ernest Camlin from Belfast, who travels down, you know, with flippers and underwater equipment. And amazingly, the press follows his journey down from Belfast, and the Sunday Independent reports that he's on the way to Athlone, and a huge crowd turns up on the day that Camlin arrives in the town, and they follow him to the lake, and he goes underwater, but surprise, surprise, he doesn't find any creature. But that's the tenor of how the debate develops over the week or two after the initial sighting.
You'd expect this to be a 9-day wonder, that by the end of 1960, everybody would have forgotten about it. But in fact, that doesn't happen, because it gains attention, the story, in Britain. And British figures really keep the story alive after May 1960.
Yeah, what you have is this group, you know, in the 60s and 70s, it seems to be the height in Britain of this craze for the Loch Ness Monster. You have this group called the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigations Bureau. And now on the surface, you know, they sound like a bunch of cranks, but they're actually very well funded, and they're, the figures that run the organisation are very well connected to the highest levels of British society. There's a guy, David James, who's a member of the Conservative Party. He's an MP. He'd been recently featured, or was just about to be featured, in This Is Your Life. So he's a well-known figure in Britain. You have Peter Scott, the only son of Robert Falcon Scott of the Antarctic. You have Richard Fitter, a reporter with The Observer. Constance White, she's a medical doctor but a very well-known author, supposedly the world's foremost expert in the Loch Ness Monster. And you have a guy, Norman Collins, who was formerly director of BBC Television and key figure in the foundation of ITV. So these people can fund any kind of crazy escapade they want to do. And one of their associates, Lionel Leslie of the Castle Leslie, the family and the estate in County Monaghan, brother of Shane Leslie, a cousin of Winston Churchill, very well-known figure. He travels to Ireland in 1965 after the Bureau had first made contact with one of the original figures in the story, Harry Royce, and he had given them as much information as he could on the initial 1960 sighting. So they come over to Ireland. Leslie comes over to Ireland in 1965 to search or hunt for the monster. Now, by that stage, the hunt had expanded beyond Loch Ree, because it had inspired sightings all around the country. You have sightings in Loch Derg, you have sightings in Loch Corrib, you have sightings in Loch Fada in Connemara. And, you know, if any listener is interested, a lot of these were recorded by RT Television at the time. You had the late Bill O'Herlihy and Cathal O'Shannon doing reports, and they're up in the RTE player. So there's a lot of interviews, including with Lionel Leslie on the RT player. And by this stage, Leslie decides that Loch Fada is his first opportunity, his prime goal, and he travels there to find the monster, but he's not looking to photograph it. He decides to set off explosives in the lake, apparently, as he put it, to force the creature to the surface, and then he could either capture it photographically or finish it off. But one way or the other, they'd have proof. And this is all captured or reported on in the Times and the Independent, the Irish press. They're all eagerly following the story. And Leslie says that his next goal is to travel to Athlone and to set off explosives in Loch Ree, but he doesn't seem to have ever got permission to carry out that particular dream.
And Lionel Leslie also featured in that 1979 RTE radio documentary.
I was with the Loch Ness expedition investigating and we got a report from the Irish Inland Fisheries enclosing a report from Father Quigley and two other priests from Loch Ree. And so I was so very interested, I went over to Dublin to interview him. I was very impressed by it because it was what he told me was so like the Loch Ness monster, only in miniature. It might be a natural freak, like the African lungfish, which can last out the whole summers in hard-baked mud by suspended animation. These creatures might do the same sort of thing in the peat. There are stories of them boring in the peat. And also they might live on decaying organic matter.
Lionel Leslie talking on that RTE 1979 documentary on lake monsters. So the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau, they didn't find it what they were looking for. I think they were looking for something called a plesiosaur, which would be a pretty coelacanthfish as well. So they didn't find anything on Loch Father, anything on Loch Ree. Was that the end of the story?
No, the story goes on because, yeah, as you said, Leslie was looking for a plesiosaur, which was, you know, if anybody with small children who are into dinosaurs would probably be familiar with the creature. They were a form of marine reptile that shared the planet with the dinosaurs, long extinct, 66 million years ago. But the thing with Leslie and all his colleagues in the Loch Ness Bureau is and to digress quickly, they had been taken in by a photo that had been published in the British Daily Mail in the 1930s. Now, at that time, as you know, the Daily Mail was interested in monsters of all kind, whether Mussolini and Hitler are the Loch Ness variety. And they had published what was called the Surgeon's Photo in 1934. We now know that was a fake. But at the time, that had apparently shown a plesiosaur-style marine reptile with big body mass, long, slender neck, a small head in Loch Ness. And that kind of established the public idea of what these monsters look like. And it was somewhat similar to what the priests, the three Irish priests, drew in 1960. But, you know, surprise, surprise, they didn't find evidence of any such creature in the Irish lakes in any of them. But the story continued on over the following decades. There's multiple reports in RTE. ITV comes over to Ireland in 1980 for a show headed by Arthur C. Clarke, the famous engineer and science fiction author, and they reassembled the three priests in Loch Ree, and they told the story again. And even up until 2001, there was scientific or purportedly scientific expeditions to the lake. A Swedish guy, Jan Sundberg, led what was called the Global Underwater Survey Team looking for monsters in Loch Ree. And again, spoiler alert, they didn't find anything. But he spoke to the Irish Times at the time, and he suggested that whatever people had seen was likely to have been a creature called a lamprey, which is similar in shape, at least, to an eel, but has a very fearsome mouth when it opens its mouth to attack with multiple teeth. And that led the Irish Times to use the cringeworthy headline, "The Loch Ree Monster Finally Brought to Eel." And I think that's the general tenor of this story. But as of this moment in time, there's never been any conclusive proof as to what the priests saw in the lake in that evening in 1960. But I think we can safely disregard the Soviet submarines, plesiosaurs, coelacanths, and so on.
So whether it was a trick of the light, whether it was submariners from Russia, an overactive imagination, or something truly mysterious, who knows, lurking beneath the waters of Loch Ree, the legend of the monster sparked wild speculation at the time and a media frenzy. Ian Kennelly, thanks for bringing us the saga of the so-called Loch Ree monster. After the break, I'll be talking to Anne Chambers, author of the recently republished T.K. Whittaker, Irishman of the 20th Century. Stay with us. Welcome back. T.K. Whittaker is credited with pulling the Irish economy out of the doldrums in the 1950s. He later became governor of the central bank, and in 2001, the then 85-year-old former civil servant outpolled historical icons, politicians and celebrities to be voted Irishman of the 20th century by Irish TV viewers. Born in 1916... he died at the age of 100 in 2017, a life that spanned the history of the Irish state, making unprecedented contributions to the evolution of that state. As we'll hear, many aspects of his life and work have particular resonance for Ireland and for indeed the world today. I'm joined now by Whitaker's biographer, Anne Chambers. Her book, T.K. Whitaker, Irishman of the 20th Century, was recently republished by Red Stripe Press. And you're very welcome back to the History Show.
Pleasure.
One of the striking things is you mention one of his earliest memories, and this, I think, puts into perspective the span of the man's life, goes back to an image from Drogheda and the Civil War.
Yes, he told me that as a young boy in his family home in Drogheda, he was about 5 years of age and he saw from his bedroom window Free State soldiers chasing a Republican with guns drawn. And that image, he said, stayed with him throughout his lifetime and really affected his future then policy behind the scenes, which he played in the search for a constitutional remedy for the crisis that was then ongoing in Northern Ireland. But that image, as a biographer, to me, that meant so much. And I could see how that image impacted on Ken Whitaker's lifetime to try and achieve peace by constitutional means in Northern Ireland, which happily he lived to see.
Tell us more about that, the title Irishman of the 20th century, inspired by that television poll, the background to it. I certainly voted for him, I know that. Not Dev, not Michael Collins, T.K. Whitaker. Well, why do you think so many people voted for this man that they would never have met and who was somebody who liked to be in the shadows?
Well, if a similar poll was held in any other country in the world, as you say, some so-called celebrity footballer or celebrity chef, I don't know, or even politician might have been elected, that the Irish people choose a former public servant as their Irishman of the century has been reinforced for me since the launch of the book. The first edition was, of course, in 2014, and he was happily alive, and the new edition came out just before Christmas. But I see that replicated myself when I give talks on Whitaker around the country. Invariably, somebody comes up to me, as they did out in Black Rock there recently, and said to me, without this man, myself and my family would be citizens of another country because I'd been forced to immigrate in the 1960s. And when I was actually interviewing Ken Whitaker for the book, we used to take a break every day and we'd go to a local hostelry where we'd have lunch. And we'd sit down at a table and I'd look around the dining area of the pub and say, who's it going to be today? Because invariably, somebody would get up, a complete stranger, come up, apologise for intruding, which indeed they weren't, and would say to Ken Whitaker, I just wanted to shake your hand. Now, what politician that we know of would ever have received? So that confirmed to me again that the Irish people would have selected him.
He was hugely important in the role that he played in shifting Ireland from De Valera's protectionism to Lamassa's free trade in the 1950s, arguing that economic openness was the key to growth and prosperity. In contrast, we are probably now going to see a resurgence of protectionist policies worldwide, starting with Trump in the USA. Mm. How do you think Ken Whitaker would view protectionist trends and what lessons from his approach back in the 50s and 60s in Ireland might still be relevant today?
Well, as you know, it was Lamassa who introduced protectionism in the 1940s and it was okay then. But by the mid-1950s, when Whitaker took over as one of the youngest, indeed, heads of the Department of Finance in the 1950s, when he took over there, he told me himself that protectionism had by then passed its sell-by date, that it had really by then was really introducing a period of economic stagnation as well as an atmosphere, he told me, of national despondency. You know, people had no hope in Ireland during the 1950s. There were 60,000 people immigrating yearly from Ireland, all the best, the young people were all leaving. And protectionism, he felt, was catering for that because there were tariffs on any foreign imports, and particularly from Britain. And he told me himself, you know, that it was like very difficult to dismantle protectionism because it was felt by these former veterans, you know, of the Civil War, the War of Independence, 1916 Rising, La Masse de Valera. It was like letting Britain in again, so to speak. So all of that had to be got over. But you were so correct when you say that La Masse himself was beginning to turn away from the protectionism that he... So they made a great team. And Whittaker then came together quietly with a team of young acolytes in the civil service without anybody asking them to do it on their own time. At weekends, they came together and he formulated the famous document Economic Development, which I suppose has acquired the status of some Magna Carta now in Irish historical...
And we all get the name wrong. We all call it the Programme for economic Expansion.
No, that came from Economic Development, the first programme for Mac, and it changed and transformed the country. You know, and it, to the day he died, really, he really looked back in a very positive way on that. And the thing that really got to him was that it was adopted by the government of La Masse and De Valera almost overnight. They were so desperate.
But timing is everything. Was he fortunate in that more of his time, more of his productive time was spent with La Masse in charge than with De Valera?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The only thing De Valera was, he said, economics really went over De Valera's head.
Even though he was a mathematician.
Exactly. That's often surprised me. But Whittaker said that it was all about the Irish language, you know, the preservation of the Irish language, which of course was important, but not at the expense of economic development. And you're so right when you see what we're faced today. History has that, as you know so well, Miles, the implacable way of repeating itself. And now we're faced again with trade tariffs and protectionism, which are going to affect this country, as we all know now, if Trump will possibly take him time to enforce his threat to the multinationals here in Ireland. And that is a big, big consideration. So I think another aspect of that would be the government's rainy day fund. You know, that people are looking to see spent in ways that are not maybe conducive now in view of what is happening. I'm sure Whittaker would have wished that the government keep that rainy day fund and indeed add the 14 billion that came from multinational tax to that, because it looks like we're going to need it down the way. And he was always looking ahead.
He was the quintessential public servant. Now, obviously, we're seeing tensions around the role of public service and public servants, with debates over their independence, their political influence, their job security. Given his legacy, what do you think he would say about the victimization, basically, of public servants today, mostly in the US or egregiously in the US, but also elsewhere?
I'd say he would be absolutely shocked. He held, as indeed did his political masters at the time, all of them held the civil servants in regard. Whittaker always said, you know, that he had a great association with politicians and he felt for them in many ways. He said, you know, as a public servant, I can advise and I'm lucky if I get 50% of what I advise. And I understand that because the politician has to sell it at the doorstep at elections. And we all don't want to see cutbacks, and we want everything to be good and dandy in the economy. But sadly, it isn't like that. And the politicians have to make, and he had great empathy and indeed sympathy for politicians. But I think for what's happening in America, he would be absolutely, as most reasonable people would be, it would be really something that he couldn't contemplate, really.
Now, he was a northerner, although he didn't live. He moved at a very early age from County Down to Drogheda. What part did he play in bringing peace to Northern Ireland, do you think?
Well, this was quite extraordinary. What I found in his papers, which I was given access to for the biography, he spent 30 years behind the scenes negotiating with people in the UK and Northern Ireland, people in the areas that he was most associated in economics, in finance, and to a lesser degree in the political field, which he left to the politicians. And he never did it, as he said himself, without the go-ahead of the incoming or the then government. He never went off on his own bat. He was a really a good citizen in that kind of way. But what he did was quite extraordinary and did affect policy documents both from the UK and from the Irish government over the years. And I have to tell you that one document I found in his collection called Northern Ireland, a Possible Solution, was the Good Friday Agreement for Slow Learners. It was written in 1971 with almost 5,000 deaths and the destruction and the alienation that occurred over the succeeding 30 years. And indeed, he said to a civil service counterpart up in the Northern Ireland, you know, if the North of Ireland had been left to us public servants, we would have done a deal much sooner.
He also gave recommendations on Ireland's neutrality and its role in European security during the 1992 Maastricht Treaty debate. Given today's discussions, I mean, it's very, very live topic all over again on NATO, EU defence, Ireland's position in this global security landscape. How relevant do you think his views are now?
Well, I think they've become very, very relevant. They possibly weren't when he met them in 1992. But, you know, while he was in total agreement with Ireland remaining neutral, he said Ireland needed to be in a position to defend itself against external aggression. And given its connection and dependence then and now on Europe, he also suggested, and I quote, that Ireland should be prepared to participate in some reasonable fashion in safeguarding the security of the European Union. You know, and he didn't mean it, as I say, by joining a military alliance, but to accept responsibility not only for defending itself against any anti-EU aggression, but also to cooperate with the EU by preventing Ireland, for example, for becoming a base for attack on another European nation. Now, all of this is like science fiction in the past, but it's very relevant today in view of what is happening in Europe, all over Europe, and certainly in view of what happened with Ukraine.
There is an award called after him, the T.K. Whittaker Award for Outstanding Contribution to Public Life, and it's awarded at the Business and Finance Awards each year. Who won it in 2022?
Well, quite extraordinary. Mr. Zelensky from Ukraine was the winner of the T.K. Whittaker Award. And in his acceptance speech, Zelensky referred to what Ken Whittaker had done for Ireland in the 1950s and 60s, which resulted in Ireland, and Zelensky said, living in Europe in peace and stability, which was now the aim of his own country.
Now, the only time I think I ever recall interviewing him and having the privilege to interview him was in connection with, it was a few years after the compilation of his prison reform report. That was came out in 1984. And that, I mean, it was a huge contribution, landmark document that addressed issues within Ireland's penal system and proposed significant reforms, most of which I think have been unfortunately largely ignored. How do the recommendations, do you think, hold up 40 odd years later?
Oh, it was really, it was the Reform of the Penal System report, and the Prisoners' Rights Organisation of that period described Whittaker's report as, and I quote, a comprehensive, enlightened and caring document. And in it he made some quite amazing recommendations. But, you know, there's everything about Whittaker, there was a practical application to it. You know, he was looking at the cost, for example, of keeping prisoners in prison. In 1984, it was around 30,000 punts at the time. He looked at it from that kind of point of view. And he wanted to, he firstly said that there should be an alternative to prison. And that this should be from confiscation of assets illegally acquired. Hence, the cab came out of that. Then you had, he said, community service instead of prison sentence for more minor crimes, which made practical sense. You had the education to be introduced into prisons because people perhaps who were in prison were there for maybe lack of education, and also you had for psychological treatment. He also suggested, which was accepted, that the day-to-day running of the prison system should be transferred from the Department of Justice to individual prison authorities, and partly that was implemented. And he also advocated the establishment of a female prison, which of course happened in Limerick. But a lot of his other suggestions sadly were shelved. But it's, that report is still there and it might be well worth re-looking at again. Mm.
You mentioned De Valera and the emphasis that he placed on the Irish language, and that's something that Ken Whittaker would have been very much in sympathy with. How do you think he would feel about the current status of the Irish language?
Well, towards the end of his life, he said he was at least happy that the Irish language has survived, but he did make the very, very valiant point, and that was that it was no longer government policy alone would suffice to keep the language going. It was up to all of us. We had to row in there. No use government legislation or anything like that. I think it's the people of Ireland who will keep the language going, and if we all did our little bit, indeed, I think he was most disappointed with me that I couldn't conduct an interview with him in Irish. My Irish had fallen by the wayside, and it was one thing that he commented on in our 60 hours of interviews. And, you know, it is a shame, and I've tried to do, you know, a little bit myself in that, and I think it's up to all of us to keep the language there.
How would you contrast the attitude to public service of Whittaker and his generation compared to the present day?
Oh, it's totally different. Ken Whittaker's political masters, you know, had fought for Irish freedom. And Whittaker, not just Whittaker, but his generation also, there were others in the public service who also had the same outlook. And they felt equally obliged to work for Ireland. You know, economic development was done, as I said, on a totally voluntary basis. There were no recompense from promotion, from top-ups, from bonuses. It was done by a group of young civil servants. Why? Because it was needed to be done for the betterment of the country. Now, say that to somebody today, and I think they would find that, let's say, anachronistic.
Well, there are many, many lessons to be learned from Whittaker's long life and contribution to society. We've heard many of the modern resonances there from Anne. We'll leave it there. The book is called T.K. Whittaker, Irishman of the 20th Century, recently republished by Red Stripe Press. The author is my guest, Anne Chambers. Anne, many thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Jamie Doyle and Paul Murnock on sound, and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.